Hey everyone in podcast land, it's Aaron, here to remind you that Timber Winter Music Festival is coming to you in Leavenworth, Washington, January 29th and 30th of this year, 2016, with artists such as Strand of Oaks, Fruit Bats, Grace Love and the True Loves, Iskadoff, and many, many more. How about Ebu? How about the Young Evils, Industrial Revelation, Benjamin Verdu? Yeah, so many, and a hot toddy garden, and me hosting the festival. It's going to be great, man. Join me for a hot toddy and snow and fun. Oh man, maybe some sledding. It's going to be great. Join me, 29th and 30th of January, Leavenworth, Washington, Timber Winter Music Festival. Get your tickets now at timbermusicfest.com. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 281 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. A wrong and drawn-out series as well. I'm your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. Boom indeed. It's our first show back of the new year. And it feels like it's been forever, which it kind of has been. I don't think I've recorded a show in over a month. Feeling a little rusty here. But thank you for coming back. I hope you all had a great holiday. What was it? A holiday weekend? No, that's not it. Holiday vacation? How about just a great holiday? I hope your Christmas, your Hanukkah, your Kwanzaa was all good. Okay, and whatever other holiday lands around there. Wow. All right. Hope you guys had a good one, and I hope you were all safe during New Year's Eve. Okay, mine was pretty good. Let's see. What did we do? We had a little, a very laid back dinner, and then had some friends over for that. Made some filet mignon. Yeah, it was great. Had some wine. Had some champagne. And then friends left, and I fell asleep pretty much at like 10 o'clock, right in the middle, smack dab in the middle of the movie Wayne's World. And it was great. It was wonderful. And then woke up to the sound of fireworks and watched the rest of Wayne's World and brought in 2016 that way, like a total champion, man. Yes. I hope yours was a little bit more eventful. It's been a while. Like I said, I'm feeling a little bit rusty, but man, I am very, very excited to come back in 2016, with this episode for you, this chat with, none other than Tom Price. Tom Price was the guitar player and, guy who started bands like the U-Men here in Seattle, and also one of my favorite bands of all time, Gashuffer. Which, if you remember back, if you've been listening to the show for any amount of time, you'll know that I periodically reference the two first shows that I ever went to as a child. One of them was a Gashuffer concert at a small little venue in Bremerton, Washington. I believe it was called the Cafe Zoo. I think it was. I've never looked into that, but I think that's what the name of it was. And then the other one was a Sonic Youth concert. Now, I get them kind of mixed up. No, I don't get the bands mixed up, you guys. I just get mixed up which concert I went to first. I think it was the Gashuffer concert. And that was my first ever show. And of course, I mean, that made a huge impression on me. And I was a huge fan of that band back in the early 90s up until now, man. So this was a huge, huge, deal for me to have Tom here in the backyard, talking about his life, talking about how he got started, and also talking about how he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Now, a little disclaimer here is that Tom is suffering from Parkinson's disease, and it has progressed quite a bit. At some points, it's a little bit difficult to hear what he's saying, and you're just gonna have to go with it, all right? Because he is dealing with the symptoms of that terrible disease. I gotta say, the guy was so cool, so great, and he's such a legend, and still playing music to this day, uses that as kind of his escape from everyday life and from being afflicted with that terrible condition. So I think you guys are really going to enjoy this, and forgive my rustiness, okay? Because it's been a while since I've had somebody back here to talk, and I was actually quite nervous, to tell you the truth, to talk with Tom Price. But let's get into it, shall we? Let's just go right there. Oh, before we do, we got to remind you, like we said at the top of the show in the little pre-roll there, Timber Winter Music Festival is coming up the 29th and 30th of this month, January, in Leavenworth, Washington. Please go get your tickets. It's going to be so much fun. It is snowing like mad up there, and there's time to go get your skiing in and then come and watch these amazing bands play. Fruit Bats has reformed for this show. Actually, you know what? I take that back. I don't know if they've reformed just for this show, but they've reformed, dude. Eric Johnson is playing again as Fruit Bats. That's a big deal. That is a big deal, my friends. Strand of Oaks, Grace Love and the True Loves, who has been on this show. Actually, Fruit Bats has been on the show, too. Hebu has been on the show. Young Evils. Man, so many great acts are going to be there. Hot Toddy Garden, Sledding, all sorts of stuff, guys, in a beautiful, beautiful spot up in the mountains, nestled in the Cascades in Leavenworth, Washington, okay? So go get your tickets, timbermusicfest.com, and join me because I am going to be emceeing the event, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're there, come up and say hi, will you? Maybe buy me a drink or something. I don't know, if you want to. Okay. So let's do this. Let's get into it. We're going to go with our first musical break off of one of my all-time favorite albums, people, Integrity, Technology, and Service by the band Gashuffer. Oh, my God. Came out back in 1992. This song is called Piano Movers. And get ready to shake your butts. All right, folks? Tom Price coming up. Can't believe it. My God. One of the first bands I ever saw live, man. Back in the backyard. This is so cool. All right. Gashuffer, Piano Movers, Air Raid Podcast. We'll be back in a moment. We'll be right back. my hearing is going, and it's like I'm constantly. My wife thinks I'm just playing it up, like I'm just not listening. But I,
you get that too.
Oh yeah, yeah. But see, you have a better reason. You were in rock bands for like what? You're still in rock bands.
Yeah.
Going on what? 30 years?
35 years or something.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Oh my god. But yeah, so you've got a good reason why the hearing's going.
Yeah, well, part of it, my left ear is particularly bad, and I can ascribe that to one specific incident.
What happened?
I mean, we were doing a sound check in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Yeah.
And they had a side fill, and I went up to test the mic, and just this searing blast of high-pitched feedback came right at me from Exact. The horn was
pointed just directly at you.
5 feet away, directly at me. And ever since then, my left ear's been a little bad. But,
oh my god! I would be pissed if that happened, man.
I was kind of pissed.
Because then, for the rest of the show, how'd the rest of the show go?
Oh, it went fine.
Yeah, you know, could you hear yourself?
Well enough.
Well enough, yeah.
But,
yeah.
But yeah, I don't like side fills very much.
Yeah. Well, Tom, it's an absolute honor to have you here. Like I told you in the kitchen, one of the first concerts I ever went to was, it must have been around, like, I don't know, 93, 94, something like that.
Yeah.
Little club in Bremerton, Washington, called Cafe Zoo. I'm fairly certain that's what it was called. And we went, my friend's brother was in a band called Nurse Diesel. And we went to go check them out and see them play for the first time, and they were opening up for Gas Huffer.
Wow. I have to confess, I don't remember Nurse Diesel.
I don't think. You guys must have played with so many bands. You yourself have played with so many bands. I don't. I was just giving a little bit of backstory. You don't have to remember. But it was such a great show. It was one of the first like small venue shows that I had ever been to, and scared me a little bit because people were stage diving and crowd surfing and stuff like that. I remember that. And also, there was another band that opened up for you guys that night, and I was all the way up by the stage, and I had my hand on the stage, and the bass player, whoever it was, he had some weird kind of like aviator cap on. And he tried to physically step on my fingers.
Huh.
Like smash my fingers with his giant Doc Martin.
And, nice guy.
Yeah, I will always remember the look on his face, on his bespectacled face.
Yeah.
Him trying to smash my fingers. A young 13, 14-year-old.
Oh,
just there to watch some music, man.
And you come away crippled.
Yeah, he didn't get me. I got away.
Good.
But like I said, man, that was one of the first shows that I ever saw. I was a huge fan of Gas Huffer. Kind of came to You Men a little bit late.
Yeah.
It's a big honor to have you here, sir.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, that's good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, totally, man. So where did are you originally from? Seattle?
I was born in Olympia, but
okay.
I've lived in Seattle since I was about 2 years old.
Washingtonian through and through.
Yeah. My parents were born in Seattle. Some of my grandparents were. So pretty hardcore Northwesterner for better or for worse.
Yeah, man. So did you grow up in Olympia?
No, mostly around here.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, did you say, maybe I misheard you, you moved up to Seattle when you were about two?
Yeah.
Or something like that? Okay, gotcha. What neighborhood?
Everywhere and nowhere. Mostly kind of around here, actually.
Yeah. And what did you do as a kid in the city of Seattle?
Hung out at the Pike Place Market with my buddies after school and stole fruit and went to the head shops down there to buy legal highs like Damiana that none of it ever worked. And
it's like basically smoking tea bags, right?
Yeah. And just hanging out downtown and trying to get in as much trouble as possible.
Yeah. You were one of those kids.
Yeah, I was one of those kids.
Did you ever focus on school much, or was that kind of not your thing?
No, not really. I knew I wanted to play music from a pretty early age.
Yeah.
And my folks, they wanted me to do well in school, but they're thinking of, well, at least he's interested in something.
Yeah.
So they were fairly supportive of my musical aspirations.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Were your parents musical at all?
Yeah, my mom's very musical. She plays piano and violin, and I learned how to play guitar from my mom and my older sister.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it was the mid-70s. I guess that's my phone.
Totally unprofessional. No.
Ignore that. It's kind of a phenomenon some people aren't familiar with today, but in the mid-70s, through the church, of all things, there was kind of the Jesus freak acoustic guitar strumming Jesus hippie type of thing.
Yeah.
And I was kind of sucked into that. And when I was 12 or something.
Yeah.
And we'd go to meetings, and they had all these, remember Ovation guitars?
Oh, yeah.
With
I hated
the
those
round
fucking
backs.
Things. Yeah, they were like, I don't know, what do you call it?
Made out of
fiberglass.
Yeah,
or something
made
like
out
that.
Of fiberglass. Yeah. They sound awful.
Yeah, just terrible.
And but for some reason, the church group, somebody had donated a bunch of Ovation acoustic guitars, so there was me and four or five other kids, all little long-haired Jesus freaks playing Ovation guitars, and you know, we learned. I kind of just grew up with acoustic guitars around and learned like Michael Row the Boat Ashore.
So it was all it was like church
Kumbaya
hymns and stuff like that.
And, yeah. And we'd go around to hospitals and play for disabled children in banana carts and wheelchairs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You have fond memories of doing that kind of thing?
It was kind of fun. The counselors or whatever you call them were kind of older hippie dudes, and they were really into Jesus freaks, but they were into the idea of questioning stuff. So you could hit them with hard questions, and they didn't mind. Like if God is so great and powerful, why are we playing for a bunch of crippled children in banana carts.
Yeah.
You know, and but eventually I, start like everybody else. I started hearing Black Sabbath and Aerosmith and the contradiction eventually became too much.
Oh, sure. Were your parents the type of people that were like, oh my God, our kid is going down like a satanic path?
No.
They, not that far?
Yeah. They probably thought that, but they were cool enough to not say that. So.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. And in that phase, I was probably more of a Jesus freak than they were.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So a strong believer.
It was just a trend in the mid-70s. Billy Graham would put on these big rallies, and there was a guy named Larry Norman who was a Christian rock and roller.
Yeah.
He'd play these big shows, and, you know, it was just kind of ridiculous.
Please tell me that was one of, like, the first shows you ever went to.
It was.
Yeah?
But what's kind of funny is, not that long after seeing Larry Norman, one of the first small shows I saw was The Mentors at a place called Blackburn Hall up here in North Seattle.
Okay.
And are you familiar with The Mentors?
No, not at all.
Consider yourself lucky. They were a...
Why?
They were a, kind of a bad heavy metal trio that wore a black Ku Klux Klan type hoods and played... They weren't Klansmen or anything. But they wore hoods and their songs were all just basically pornographic and...
Okay, so I was getting the impression that this was like a different like a really cheesy kind of Jesus band.
No.
Or Christian rock band.
No.
This was like complete opposite.
Complete opposite.
Yeah. And they were from here?
They're from here.
Yeah. The Mentors.
Yeah, they eventually moved to L.A., but... Yeah.
How'd it go for them?
They got some attention. They were... Their singer and drummer was a guy named Eldon Hoke, who went by the name El Duce, and...
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, and when the... you familiar with the PMRC?
Yeah.
Parent Music Resource Center. They had congressional hearings.
They were part of that? Tipper Gore?
Yeah, Tipper Gore brought them up as an example of... the evil of rock and roll. And there's a famous recording of some decrepit old senator reading Mentors lyrics in Congress, like, "Girl, bend up and smell my anal vapor." And, Frank Zappa, I think, sampled that.
Oh, of course he did. And, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so in interviews, El Duce would tell people, "I love the PMRC because we started
oh,
getting $500 bucks a show, right, all the publicity you could want."
Exactly, man. Yeah, that's great. That's good. Good for them.
Yep.
Good for them. So you saw this show up here in North Seattle with the Mentors, and it kind of changed you around, huh?
A little bit, yeah. That was the first. The Mentors weren't actually a punk rock band per se, but some of their fans were, and that was the first time I saw like punk rockers. This is in probably 1977 or something.
Okay.
And I was pretty fascinated with that because back then the divide between punk rock and everything else was so much more massive than it is now.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
The first day I went to Roosevelt High School wearing straight leg jeans.
Yeah.
I might as well have had a purple mohawk and been butt naked. It was just like silence in the halls. People like, "Oh my God, what is he wearing?" You know.
Right.
At that time, everybody had feathered hair, down jackets, and bell bottoms.
Yeah.
And then when me and my buddies cut our hair off and had short hair, that was like... I mean,
it's so insane how things swing.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, you know, my dad would tell me stories about how he would grow his hair out to basically the length that I have now, which is, you know, almost looks like a comb over.
Yeah.
Because I'm hiding some baldness that's creeping up, you know. And my grandma, I just recently saw my grandmother for Christmas. Like she actually kind of chastised me for having long hair like this, which is not very long, right?
Not very long.
No. And it's just, I mean, it looks nice. It's combed over to the side.
Yeah.
It's parted to the side. I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those days, everything was, I think it was, I kind of caught the backlash of the 60s, you know, like, everybody wanted to go back to normal, and so there was this, it was weird. It was
yeah.
Long hair and bell bottoms were the norm. Somebody somewhere decided that that was okay and that everybody should be like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you did anything else, you'd really stand out.
You'd
really get a lot of hell for it.
Yeah. Well, it's like the younger generation was basically finding the beatnik generation, almost, a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Like it was kind of a revert back to I don't know, for lack of a better term, the greasers and the socias, you know, back in the 50s or something.
Yeah.
You know? The same style of dress and growing out the sideburns, things like that. I don't know. Yeah. Did that more come in the 80s or 90s or was that something that was around in the 70s too?
What was
kind of the revert back to kind of the 50s style?
Oh yeah, that kind of happened a little later, I think.
Okay,
but I'm glad that kids nowadays they have more options.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So in a way, it's like punk rock won, you know. our children can dye their hair blue and wear whatever the hell they want to school, and it's okay. Nobody hardly bats an eye.
Sure. So. I think a lot of people would disagree with you, though, in that. Yeah. Because they say, you know, like punk rock kind of became a corporate entity, almost.
Oh, sure. There's plenty of bad mall punk out there.
Yeah,
Fall Out Boy or whatever that crap is.
Sure.
But, you know, that's always going to happen. I used to love Blondie. Then they did Heart of Glass. And I was like, what? They're playing disco. Oh, my God. You know, and you'd get a Clash album, and there's a bunch of dub bores on it.
Right.
And you're like, what the hell is this? You know, so, I don't know.
It's the record executives, man. They got their hands on it, and they needed to make it a little bit more poppy.
Yeah.
Digestible to the masses.
Yeah.
Right?
I guess so.
So, when you were kind of getting into punk rock... Like, what was going on in your mind? I mean, are you still somebody who has a lot of faith? Do you still go to church, or was that kind of around the time when you were making a switch?
I still go to church every once in a while.
Yeah?
Just because I like bone-rattling organ music and stained glass.
Yeah,
Don't worry, I'm not.
No.
I'm not a Jesus. Hallelujah, people! I'm not one of those, but that fell away for a long time, and I don't know. What was the question?
Did you lose your? Did at any point in that your childhood, did you lose your faith?
There was no. One great moment where I just went, this is BS, you know, and...
More of a gradual slide?
Yeah.
A little bit?
Yeah. Just kind of got... Just something that fell away. It was in the background because I was into other stuff.
Yeah.
You know? But it's kind of funny. People sometimes friends will tease me now, like, you're such a moderate mainstream Democrat, and you go to church every one, you know, twice a year with your mom, and you're getting so old and square. And I have to tell them, like, you know, when I was a 17-year-old fire-breathing punk rocker, I would still vote. When I was 18, I would still vote for moderate Democrats and go to church a couple times a year with my mom.
You just didn't tell anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. All my friends were into crass and anarchism.
And
on election day, I'd kind of always look and sneak off to go vote for Walter Mondale or whoever.
That's hilarious, man. So when did you really start playing in bands? Like, what was the first project that you started in?
I played in bands with my buddies at school, but uh-huh. the first band that ever did any shows was a trio called Psychopop.
Okay.
And I played bass and sang in that band, sang about half the songs.
Okay.
And my buddies Al and Nick played guitar and drums, and we never put out any records, but we played over a couple of years. We played quite a few shows. We opened for the Undertones at the Showbox, and we played. Our first show was with the Fastbacks. It was their first show also.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
How'd that go?
It was great.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah?
Very vividly.
Uh-huh.
I was scared to death.
Yeah, walk me through that, man. Because I remember my first show, and it was the worst, but the best at the same time.
Yeah. It was just at a hall somewhere, and we put together, we built the stage and cobbled the PA together.
Yeah.
And we were playing with the Vanes, which was Duff McKagan, his early band, and the Fastbacks. And I just remember thinking a few minutes before our set, oh, God, why did I think it would be a good idea to do concerts? I'm scared to death.
Yeah. And you got that feeling in the pit of your stomach.
It's like just going into combat for the first time in Vietnam or something.
Oh, my God.
I almost barfed. Uh-huh. I was so nervous. It's actually, I always kind of did get nervous before shows until just a few years ago. Really?
Yeah. Still had that
jitters. Yeah. Not anymore, though. I think because the music I'm doing now is just so easy to play.
Oh, really? All right, let's take our second musical break, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
When you're walking on the beach, there's always millions right in reach. Ain't got no time to wonder why they're catching air, but they can't fly. They're pretty sure they will rule this little planet bye-bye. Hopping with their heads up high, they're confident they'll never die. They're simply ears. They're powered by a mannequin. They never wonder who'd be the kings and queens. I might see it a little bit like you and me. They're safe.
And how old were you when you started that one?
15, 16. Then when I was about 17, we broke up. We weren't around for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And started the U-Men after that.
Right.
which was Psychopop was more like a straight The Jam or The Clash style.
Okay.
Punk band.
Yeah.
The U-Men were something else.
Very, very different.
Yeah.
Very grungy, kind of very garage, but hardcore, almost.
Kind
of. Verging on that, anyway.
Yeah, but kind of spiky, too. Lots of riffs and,
and
dissonance and kind of avant-garde, too. When we started out, actually, we were still more in the pop punk vein, believe it or not, but that didn't last too long.
So, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because at that point, about 1980, the original punk rock scene had pretty much imploded, and you had all this hardcore punk starting. After Black Flag came along, and
right.
And rockabilly, as you mentioned earlier, and things were a lot more split up, sectionalized.
Right. Yeah, it was like a bunch of I don't know, spines kind of branching off.
Right, right.
From the original line.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there were a lot of people, I felt, instead of trying to come up with original music, they were trying to fit into whatever would make them popular with a certain segment of the audience.
Trying to get into a genre.
Trying to fit into a genre.
Yeah.
Which, and, you know, these are, I'm talking about young bands. Young bands always do stupid stuff like that. But at that point, I was ready to try and think up something that was different. Very influenced by bands like Public Image and Gang of Four.
Yeah.
The Blackouts. And at the same time, I was also starting to listen to quite a bit of rockabilly and surf and garage rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were kind of trying to fuse that stuff together. And it took us a long time. We played really crappy music for a long time. We were really bad.
Toying with this new genre that you were trying to come up with.
Yeah. All kinds of evolutionary dead ends that we experimented with. But eventually we sort of, I think, semi-successfully fused it all together. I just say that because our audience was great. We'd play and there'd be mods and rockabilly dudes and hardcore punks and art weirdos and everybody coming to see us. And
I am not the type of person that likes rockabilly. I never really have been. But for some reason, when I found out about Gashuffer, it just fit.
Yeah.
It wasn't totally rockabilly, although the lead singer
kind of twangy.
Totally. But it was punk. It was rockabilly. It was grunge. It was it was all those kind of intertwined together, and it was a great sound. When did you first kind of noticed that gelled? I think you were about to get there, but
with the U-Men?
With I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
That would be when we had a bass player named Robbie Buchan, who was good, but she always played at just ridiculously loud volume and would drown out the whole band. And she had great melody, melodic feel, but not a whole lot of rhythm, and she played so loud she couldn't hear the rest of the band anyways.
Right, right.
So, she was great. I wish I had a tape of just her playing the bass by herself. That would have been a great band, just her. But But we eventually, she quit the band after a couple of years. We got a guy named Jim Tillman on bass, and he was a really, really good musician.
Yeah.
And that made the rest of us, we all had to up our game a little.
Okay,
and
okay.
That's when that came together.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And that was really fun getting him because he was just so good. And for me, it was, after we got him, I didn't have to keep ride herd on the rest of the band. You've probably been in this situation where you're playing a song with some guys who, some people who aren't that experienced or whatever, and you're showing them the chords and you're playing along.
Right.
And they're doing okay, and then you go, okay, I'm going to take a solo. And you go for a solo, and as soon as you do, the band falls apart.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I've also been the guy who accidentally makes it fall apart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure.
And I've been on both sides of that fence.
Yeah.
So you had, I mean, everybody started to kind of lift it up.
Yeah.
Because you had, all of a sudden, you had a really solid musician that joined the group.
Yeah, and he was kind of a, he had kind of an engineer's brain. He'd that amplifier is no good, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You gotta change these settings around. You could fix stuff, and our equipment got better. And also, our drummer Charlie Ryan was getting really good at that time. And John Bigley, he was always kind of a wild card. You never really knew what he was gonna do, but he started actually singing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So at this point, too, like, are the U-Men kind of gaining traction in the Seattle scene? Because you guys have kind of this weird cult status here, especially in the city of Seattle now.
Yeah.
But did you see that back then in the 80s? Like, was that apparent?
There was a period of 3 or 4 years or maybe more where we were actually pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
We'd get, you know, not huge or anything, of course, but we'd get good crowds, sell out nightclubs and stuff here.
And you were touring
touring, and so, you know, a familiar story. Great, we just played for 500 people in Seattle.
Right.
And now we're playing for 3 people in Topeka.
Yeah.
You know. But there were a few little... we were kind of popular down in Texas for some reason, and in Boston and weird places like that.
Yeah,
So
you're gaining a national audience.
Yeah, little bit. That was, but it was always up and down. You know?
Yeah, for sure. So when did things kind of end with U-Men and float into the next iteration, which would be Gasshoffer?
Yeah, that would have been around 87, 88.
Okay.
The U-Men just kind of fizzled out. You know, there was nothing too dramatic. Just
everybody just kind of
moved on to other stuff.
Yeah.
And my roommate at the time was my buddy Don Blackstone, who plays with me today in the Desert Classic.
Yeah.
And he was on bass then, of course. But he and I started a band, and everybody else in the band knew me, but they didn't know each other. Matt Wright singing and Joe Newton on drums. And it worked when we all got together.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was such a relief because the U-Men was like, personality-wise, it was psychotic. It was just...
Were you guys getting into it with each other a lot?
It was just a constant war.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, we were always on each other's case.
Over anything and everything.
Over anything and everything.
Yeah.
And with Gasshoffer, I made a conscious decision to ask guys who were more a little more stable to play with me. And sometimes I'd get people, old friends, going, you were better when you played with a bunch of nut jobs, you know, but that's a little hard to live with after a while.
Oh, sure, so, sure. Yeah, it's draining, yeah, right?
Very, very draining.
Yeah, I mean, you can't keep, you just can't keep that up. And that's why bands like that break up all the time, right? Yeah, you can't sustain that. It's like it's totally emotionally draining.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. And this is where, like, this is what I was talking about a little bit earlier. I think I was kind of skipping ahead in your timeline there, but I thought it was more Gashuffer that kind of that sound that you were going for, the mix of like the you know, grunge or alternative sound and the rockabilly and the punk kind of all gelled together super nicely.
Yeah.
Was that the case for you?
Well, in The Human, we did a little bit of rockabilly inflected stuff as well.
Sure.
But I think you're right. I think Gashuffer actually had maybe a little more varied sound than we usually got credit for, but you're absolutely right. That kind of a punkabilly thing did seem to be our kind of core sound.
Sure, sure.
And it's funny because we weren't like big rockabilly fans, really. I mean, I like Carl Perkins and Gene Vincent and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I love that style of guitar playing. But it's not like... you know, we're sitting around and, you know,
lighting your guitar on fire and jump around the stage. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, we were trying to play some fast hard rock, and it just seemed, with Matt's voice, you know, it just seemed a natural thing to put the twang in there.
Sure, yeah. And it was kind of, I mean, it kind of had almost a comedic edge to it, too.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. I remember a lot of those songs were a little bit funny.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah, man. And I think that's why it reached me, too. Like, the sense of humor that was in that music, that was still, it wasn't like it was a comedy album.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like a throwaway comedy album like I would consider like a Weird Al Yankovic or something like that. You listen to it once or twice and you're like, yeah, I get it. Okay, that's great. But this was like real music that you guys were writing and pouring your hearts into and having fun with it at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really came through, and that's why it reached me so. Yeah.
And so what happened right at the same time we came along? Grunge, heavy,
right.
Oh, serious, dramatic stuff, and not all of it, but
sure.
But
sure.
Yeah, talk about being in the right place at the right time with the exact wrong music.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because you didn't really fit that mold at all.
No.
At all.
No. No.
But somehow, you still found an audience.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's something a lot of people kind of forget, is that right at the same time that the grunge thing was happening, there was also a real explosion of garage rock.
Yes.
And surf music.
Mm-hmm.
Bands like the Mummies and the Untamed Youth and tons of others. And I think it was just one of those periods where just economically, demographically, everything came together. There was just a bunch of people, not especially young people, people in their late 20s, mid to late 20s, who just had enough money that they could buy decent equipment, and there are just a lot of people hitting the bars around Capitol Hill, and there's just a whole group of people that were just all into hanging out and playing music. at the same time. So I'd say that was, you know, as much as I'm dubious about grunge, it was a good period for music in general.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, there was a lot of live music going on. There was a lot of clubs. There were a lot of booking agents. There were a lot of independent labels, you know.
Yeah.
So it was...
Like Epitaph, which you guys signed to, right?
Well, that was a little later.
Oh, was it?
In a way. Our first two albums were on Empty Records, which was a local label.
Oh, okay.
And... I mean, Epitaph was the same era, of course, but for us, that came a little later.
Yeah. Was that an exciting thing?
At first, I was really nervous about it, because I was not sure how they wanted to sign us.
Yeah.
And to a 3-album deal, and I wasn't sure at that point in my life how ready I was to commit to that, to the touring, and you know, for a while there, for several years, we were touring twice a year, 5-6 months out of the year, and in between we we were in the studio in between working on records, and it was a lot of work. I definitely got into it once I got over it. Once we went down to L.A. and met everybody. We really liked them. And it was a fun period because we did a lot of traveling and, you know, a lot of recording, and we didn't have to pay for any of it. So,
yeah. That's always a bonus, right?
Yeah. And at that time, Epitaph, you know, they had all these huge hits with The Offspring and NoFX and Pennywise, I guess, was
big. Right,
right. And so you'd come up with some crazy idea, and they'd go, yeah, sure.
You know? Let's try it.
Yeah.
Well, that's got to be pretty fun, man, like experiencing that and being on, I don't know, a label that was on the up.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be a pretty cool experience.
Yeah, it was the weird thing about it was we never felt like we were an Epitaph band,
right?
Per se, fitting the Epitaph sound.
Uh-huh.
But there were other bands on Epitaph at the time that we related to, like the Red Ants and the Humpers, and it was kind of like the. There were the big Epitaph bands, and there was kind of the varsity crew, but we liked all those guys.
Yeah.
It was fun. We spent a lot of time hanging out in L.A., and they'd take us around to, you know, you go to a nightclub, and there's Lemmy, and you go to a restaurant, and there's Barbara Streisand, and, you know.
Did you ever get to meet Lemmy?
Once.
Yeah.
In Seattle, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. That was a sad death.
Yeah. That hit me hard. That really bummed me out.
Yeah, bummed me out, too. I mean, I think everybody kind of saw it coming when he came out with, you know, the diagnosis of cancer.
Yeah, and Filthy, the drummer from Motorhead, died just a few weeks ago, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like 3 or 4 months ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The original drummer.
Right. Yeah, that's a sad one, man. Yeah. And, dude, what a life, though.
Yeah.
He lived it to his fullest extent, I think.
Yes, he did.
So, I mean, on the Lemmy tip, like, were drugs and alcohol ever a problem with any of the bands that you were in?
Yeah, all of them.
All of them?
Yeah. The current band, not so much.
Yeah. Everybody's kind of grown out of that a little bit.
Yeah. Part of it was like we were talking about stage fright earlier.
Sure.
You know, if you drink 3 or 4 beers before the set, you won't be as nervous.
Yeah, and then you just keep on going.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, did all that stuff, went through all that. Mm-hmm. Not so much drugs, but a lot of alcohol.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I don't look back on it and go, oh, God, what a fool I was, you know, because I was, but if I hadn't been drinking and taking drugs, I wouldn't have even attempted half the crazy shit I did back then.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
So, you know, when you're younger and you feel more indestructible, it's kind of fun. You go out and partying and you meet all kinds of weird people and get and find yourself in all these incredibly stupid situations doing bizarre stuff where you look back and go, what was I thinking?
Right.
But, you know, I wasn't thinking. I'm not saying that's good, but was living in the moment.
Sure. You know. A lot of that going on.
Yeah. Like, hey, we're in Rome. Let's go break into the Colosseum in the middle of the night.
Wait, did you do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Let's go climb the fence and go all the places where you're not supposed to go.
Did you get caught?
No.
No?
No. 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 What was funny was...
it's a good thing they have a great security system there.
Yeah, yeah. Our road manager, whoever stayed with the van outside the Colosseum, and he's standing there looking at the Colosseum, and it's pretty late at night, but the police came up to him and go, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm looking at the Colosseum, you know? Tourist attraction.
Yeah. And they just left him alone, moving on?
Yeah, eventually. But, you know, just... I could go down that wormhole for 12 hours, just the
oh, I'm sure.
insane, stupid stories.
Yeah. So Gashuffer was together for quite a few years.
Yeah, I think
you guys,
16 years.
Finally disbanded in 2006, right?
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that was that you guys were together that long.
Yeah. We started in 1989.
Wow.
So.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty good run.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. In Gashuffer, we got to do a lot of touring overseas, which none of us had ever done before. So that was really exciting. I'm really glad I had the opportunity to go to Europe and Japan and stuff for free.
So, yeah, that's pretty amazing, man. Yeah. And so in, what was it, around 2000, though, you were diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, it would have been about 2000. It's hard to say when exactly I had it. I've certain symptoms of it I've really basically had all my life.
Like what?
Just kind of shaky hands and... Uh-huh. And occasional space outs, you know, serious bad ones. But when it started getting bad, I had no idea that I had Parkinson's.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know anybody my age who had it.
Yeah, and this was about, like, 2000 or
so?
Yeah,
when I would have been about... 30 something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it starts out your hips and your elbows hurt. And it's like, when that happens, you don't think, oh, Parkinson's.
Right, you think you bumped it or whatever.
Tennis elbow or something.
Sure.
And, but it didn't go away. And I had it full on for at least a couple of years before I finally went to an actual neurologist as opposed to a family doctor or whatever.
Yeah.
And he took one look at me and said, oh, yeah, you've got Parkinson's.
Now, what would that feel like? I mean, you're still young at this point. Getting news like that, it's got to be pretty devastating.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of like getting a brick thrown at your chest.
Sure.
And it was like, holy, you know, because... I didn't really even know what Parkinson's was.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And But, you know, it's something you adjust to, you know. It's not fun, but there are worse things you can have.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Now, when you found out, though, like, did that send you into a spiral at all? I mean...
Well, I had two young kids at the time.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you did. They're teenagers now. Yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't really have time to go into a spiral.
Yeah.
And also, it wasn't that bad. You know, it's a progressive disorder.
Yeah.
And for several years, I could still basically function normally.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much most of the time.
Yeah.
No, that's a good question. I've never really thought about it. Did I? I knew it affected me, you know, but like I said, I just didn't have time to be moping too much with two young kids. I tell you, though, one thing that was really amazing about it, though, was I spent my whole life being kind of a rock and roll freak, a punk rocker, kind of a quote-unquote outsider, to be dramatic. So I figured being a person with Parkinson's, a disabled person, psychologically it wouldn't be that big of a jump from being a weirdo outsider. But, man, I was wrong.
Yeah?
Dead wrong.
How so?
Being disabled, having a disability, it's weird, the psychological impact. It's really hard to adjust to.
Yeah.
And,
I imagine that people look at you different, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, you walk into a store and people and security comes, you know.
Like, really?
Yeah, like here's a shaky weirdo in here, and
they think you're drunk.
Street person,
drunk,
or on drugs.
Yeah,
and you know, it's real easy to fall into going, screw it. I just don't want to deal with it. I'm just not going to go to the store. I'm going to stay home.
Yeah.
But
you kind of have to. I mean. When things started to get a little bit worse, did you have to kind of make yourself get up and move and do those things? Like, you know, keep up with the regular life?
Yeah. Yeah, you have to force yourself to get out there and do stuff and remain active. And the thing is, the more... some people with Parkinson's keep it pretty private. And I totally respect that. But for me, what worked better was being open and public about it.
Yeah.
Because then when people understood what was going on with me and got used to seeing me at the grocery store, I became a lot more relaxed about it.
Right.
And everybody else did too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. You know. Well, and you kind of take it, it's almost like a person like me would. If you have an insecurity about something, I will always, or if I have a security about some insecurity about something, I will always push it out there, right? I'll always make it known. You know, like if I'm, you know, it's going to sound really shallow and stuff, but if I'm at a pool, a public pool or something like that with my shirt off, I'd be like, oh, you know, my stretch marks are getting bigger. You know, I just, you know.
Thanks for sharing
that.
Say
that real nice and loud so everybody's like, ah, the guy, he knows he's got stretch marks on his love handles. Okay, we can move on. Right? Is that part of it? Like where you want to just kind of take control of the situation and it's on your terms?
Well, there's probably an element of that.
Sure.
It's basically just people getting used to me and me getting used to being the way I am. Another funny thing about Parkinson's is not so much nowadays, but sometimes I feel fine. For many years there would be you know, I was on a medication cycle.
Kind of slow things down.
Yeah, at one point, at certain points in that cycle, I'd look terrible. Could barely move.
Really?
And other times, I'm fine. Just walking around like normal. And that was really confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, they hear you've got Parkinson's. And to me, it was a normal part of life. But it took me a long time to understand how weird that is for people. You know, like, you're blind one day and you can see the next.
Right, yeah.
And people get really confused and they couldn't tell if I was faking it or something.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
But there again, people just get used to you. And you just explain to them that you're on a med cycle. Sometimes you can function, sometimes you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm not in a wheelchair yet, but I'm imagining the day when I am and being in public, wheeling along and going, hey, I feel fine. And standing up, you know, people go, hey,
this guy's you're cheating.
you're cheating to get a disabled parking space.
Right. No, I think it, you know, and that's my brother had a very rare disease for many years, and we actually ended up doing a bone marrow transplant, him and I, and he was cured of the disease a few years back. And it was a very difficult thing to watch because very little was known about his condition for many, many years. And it was the same thing where he would have like super duper lows where he would spend months in the hospital, you know, surgery after surgery after surgery. And then highs where it was like he's fine for, you know, months or something like that. No problems whatsoever. You know, and it's a tough thing to watch as being a family member. And I'm always amazed at, you know, people like yourself, people like my brother, who have to live with it and just take it, you know. I mean, I guess that's what you have to do, right? You have to turn it into, like, this is just day to day, man.
Yeah. I mean,
you're just dealing with it. You have to.
Yeah. I mean, what are the options?
You know? You really don't. You don't have any other choice, right? Yeah. There is no other choice.
Well, one thing that I'm going to be facing soon is it's called DBS, deep brain stimulation, where they drill a couple holes in your head and put a couple electrodes type things on your spine and your back of your brain.
Okay. Yeah.
And
what's that for?
That's for reducing your dependency on medication.
Okay.
To survive.
Okay.
And that's something I'm wrestling with now because most people say it's the greatest thing that happened to them since they were diagnosed with Parkinson's. They
feel really?
Like they got their life back. But then occasionally you hear a person say, I got that, and I feel like crap ever since.
Yeah. Is it a small percentage of people that it doesn't work with? Or?
It used to be about 50-50. They've gotten better at doing it now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a much higher customer satisfaction rate. But you have little...
God, it's scary, though,
man. They run wires down your neck and the inside, and you have little batteries...
Under your skin, right?
Under your skin,
yeah,
in your chest.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh boy, my wife will find that sexy, I'm sure.
I love that you have a good sense of humor about it, man. Now, has music been kind of like, has music stayed kind of like this constant in your life? Like during this, you know, this whole time
absolutely.
Of being diagnosed?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm totally dependent on music. If I didn't have that outlet for expressing myself, I don't know if I'd still be here, you know.
Well, maybe you'd just be a really piss poor painter.
I'd like to think that I'd be a mediocre painter.
I love it, man. I love it. Now you're in this. So you're in the group called Tom Price and the Desert Classic.
The Tom Price Desert Classic.
The Tom Price Desert Classic. You guys
the
are playing?
The Tom Price Desert Classic.
Which is great. It's a perfect mix of basically everything that you've ever done, I think.
Yeah, kind of.
And it takes me back to listening to your music when I was a kid. And I'm really enjoying the shit out of it, man.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I got some really good guys in that band.
Yeah, yeah.
Got Martin Bland on drums. He's a Australian expat.
Uh-huh.
And he's not only is he a great drummer, he's also really has really good ears. He's a great producer and mixer and arranger.
Yeah, yeah.
And got this monster on the bass named Joe Kilbourne. He's great. And my buddy Don Blackstone has moved from bass to guitar.
Awesome.
And when bass players move to guitar, look out. They're like, hey, I'm free.
I got more things to do.
Yeah, I don't have to listen to the drummer anymore.
Right.
Yeah, he's having a blast playing guitar, and he's gotten really good over a relatively short period of time.
Uh-huh. And you guys are playing a couple shows coming up, right?
We have one show coming up on the 16th of January and with the Riff Brokers and Tales from the Birdbath at the Fun House.
Awesome.
And then we have a couple other things that we're working on.
And do you guys have that? Is it online? Can we find out more about that on your Facebook page?
On our Facebook page, and we recently got a manager of all things.
What?
Yeah. I wouldn't say she's formally a manager, but
is that Emily? Emily who's helping you out?
Yeah, somebody.
She's great, man, I love her.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Yeah. Basically, what she does is she's the not technically incompetent person who helps us technically incompetent people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think we're going to have a website pretty soon.
Oh, my goodness.
She walked me through buying a domain name,
yeah,
which to me is like... La-di-da.
I still
know what you're talking about.
I still have problems with all that stuff. I can't keep my mind straight when it comes to the web stuff. Yeah. Can't do it.
Oh, and another good thing she's helping us with is the Desert Classic album, Hell. It came out a while ago on vinyl, but I think pretty soon it's going to be on digitally available.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
It'll be downloaded.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we've decided yet if we're going to charge money for it or not. But
you got to charge a couple bucks.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it works out doing it for free and saying, send us some money if you have some.
Right.
that seems to be the way a lot of stuff goes these days.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
That's been hard for me to adjust to.
Oh, I'm sure.
The whole changing nature of the music industry.
Yeah.
I'm used to print stuff up on vinyl. Even CDs kind of left me in the dark a little bit. But not having an actual product, a physical product to sell. It's, you know, you look at the American top 20 sales list. There are bands in the top 10 that have sold 22,000 CDs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like...
And it's all singles. It's all MP3s off of iTunes or something like that. Yeah, totally.
So that's changed a lot, and that's... I've been having a hard time keeping up with all that. It's too abstract for me, but...
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, you don't see it, right? It's a number on a computer screen rather than an actual box of, you know, goods that you're actually sending out to people that are ordering it and stuff like
but
that.
But the good thing about it, well, I'm sure there are various good things about it, but the good thing about it from my point of view is a few years back, everybody assumed that live music would be dead pretty soon.
Yeah.
Everything would all be digital. And, you know, there'd be no rock clubs, there'd be no live bands, and they were certainly wrong about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Bands, there are just as many live bands as there ever were.
Because
you can't make money off of records anymore.
Exactly.
So everybody has to play live.
Mm-hmm.
Back when they, at a point when they... And some of us would have assumed that we would be studio musicians by now. There's no more studios, really. And,
right.
And everybody's playing live.
It's totally flipped. Yeah.
And in a way, that's kind of a cool thing.
I think it is, too. And I think it's great that that you're still playing music, man, and that it's still kind of, you know, that safe haven for you.
Well, at this point, I guess it's just habit. I don't know what else to do if I'm not playing in a band.
Sure.
I guess there's crossword puzzles or something. But
it's all about Sudoku, man.
Sudoku's good. I like Sudoku. I just love music.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that point where you're playing in a club somewhere and there may or may not be a bunch of people there. You may or may not sound great. I don't know. But you look out and there's people there who want to be there. And there are people who are kind of having their minds blown. They've never seen anything like this before. And I know it sounds totally corny, but there's a great little community there of musicians and bands and fans and artists and stuff.
Sure.
And insane record collector geeks and stuff. So.
Well, I got to tell you, man, it's an absolute honor, like I said, when we met in the kitchen. It's an absolute honor to finally meet you after, what, 26 years?
The honor is all mine. Thank you for... putting up with my inane ramblings.
Not at all, man. This has been a real treat. Tom Price, thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, there you have it, folks. Tom Price. God, he was here in the backyard, man. Oh, my God. That was so great. That was so great. Sorry about the audio issues on this one. I don't know what was going on. Like I said at the beginning of the show, I'm feeling a little rusty, man. Feeling a little rusty on this. So bear with me, okay? I'm getting back into the swing of things. But I thought that was a great chat. Very, very interesting to hear about, you know, his battle with Parkinson's and that kind of thing, man. Just a little bit heartbreaking, don't you think? Yeah. But he was here, man. He was here in my backyard. And he touched my guitars. We talked about guitars for a little bit off air. It was so great. Oh, my God. Oh, that was awesome. Oh, thank you so much to Tom Price for coming and doing the show. That was great. And also thank you to Emily Shepherd, who is his wonderful manager. And she set the whole thing up. And very, very grateful to her. So if you're listening, Emily, thank you very much. Okay, you can subscribe to Air Raid on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. Only takes a couple seconds. Give us a star rating, and it really helps us out in the long run. We are also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, Cairo Radio, and Spreaker apps. Now available at the Adore Network at adore.fm. Or just visit air-raid.net to subscribe directly to our RSS feed. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/theairraidpodcast or follow us on Twitter at airraidnet or email me directly at aaron@air-raid.net. We got a ton of emails in the last couple weeks, so I need to. I'm still working on getting back to a lot of you, okay? But it's gonna take a little bit. All right. If you're a band, please email our booker, Elliot. She is a wonderful person, and she will get back to you as soon as she possibly can to line something up or get a demo from you. So email her at booking, at air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge. Tell somebody about this here show, all right? Spread the word. All right, we're going to end this episode. This is the Tom Price Desert Classic. This is called, Race to the Grave by the one and only Tom Price. Man, what a honor. All right, Race to the Grave by Tom Price Desert Classic. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. Have a good one. I was alive for a little while, then I got sick, man, so sick.
Time goes by, I don't know.